Well, welcome back to part two of our introduction to American law, or lesson two, that is, of introduction to American law. I'm Richard Clem, recording this today on March 27th, 2020. If for more information about this and other courses, please visit my website, richardclem.com. Anyway, today in lesson number two, we're going to be continuing our look into constitutional law, and the text for this portion of the program is pages 24 through 46 of the text, and we start with the question of why is it that the courts and the Supreme Court in particular, why is it that they are the ones who interpret the Constitution? Why do we have these nine old men and women doing that job? Why do you know? And that seems, at first blush, that seems like kind of a self-evident question, because we're kind of used to 200 years of that being the system. But I guess we ought to remind ourselves that that's not the way that it necessarily has to be. There could be some other system in place, some other way of deciding what exactly the Constitution says, but it's fallen upon the courts, and again, ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court, to decide what the Constitution means. Or in other words, we have our courts interpret the Constitution, and through what we'll call the power of judicial review. We'll talk a little bit more in about a second. But I should start out by saying, though, that power of judicial review, the power of the courts to interpret the Constitution, that's something that is not explicitly mentioned anywhere within the text of the Constitution. That's evolved over the years, and it really has its root in 1803, in the decision of Marbury v. Madison. That is the case where the U.S. Supreme Court asserted that it had the power of judicial review, because it had before it a statute, and it declared that statute unconstitutional. They did it in kind of a sneaky fashion. It was a dispute between the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans. Because Jefferson of the Democratic Republican Party had just taken office, and prior to leaving the White House, the outgoing Federalist president, President Adams, filled a lot of various government positions, granted commissions, including one to a Mr. Marbury, who had a relatively unimportant justice of the peace appointment, but he was appointed by President Adams to serve as justice of the peace, and he was a Federalist, so President the incoming President President Jefferson didn't particularly want that person to be appointed, or the other people in that category. So he said, "Well, we're not going to give you your job." Mr. Marbury went to court. He went to the U.S. Supreme Court, because I believe they had original jurisdiction at the time in that case. But that doesn't matter. The fact is, it was before the U.S. Supreme Court, and he said, "Well, look, I got the proper paperwork here, signed by President Adams, and I want to take over my job. So I want you to order President Jefferson to let me start doing my new job, because I was duly appointed by the outgoing president." The Chief Justice, Justice Marshall of the U.S. Supreme Court, he was also a Federalist. He agreed with the he was aligned with the Federalist point of view, and. So I guess if he was going to be a partisan, you would expect him to rule in favor of Mr. Marbury. But in kind of a brilliant solution, he ruled against Mr. Marbury. He ruled in favor of President Jefferson. So President Jefferson won the case, and there was really no way that you know how if you know you can there are various things you can do if you lose a case, but there's really not much you can do if you win a case. So President Jefferson won the case, and Mr. Marbury lost the case, so Mr. Marbury went packing, and he never became a justice of the peace. But the clever way that Justice Marshall accomplished that was by making a very Federalist ruling in opposition to what President Jefferson would have supported, because he Jefferson won on a position that he had not taken. Because the Supreme Court looked at it and said, well, wait a minute, we don't have jurisdiction in this case, because the statute that gave us this court jurisdiction, that statute was unconstitutional. So you're right, President Jefferson, you win this case because the other side came into court based upon this unconstitutional statute. We're going to strike that statute down as being unconstitutional. Well, Jefferson did not want to give the Supreme Court that power to overrule statutes, but what can he do about it? Because he won the case. So it was a very clever way of doing it. In retrospect, after 200 years, it seems like a perfectly logical ruling, because very famous words of Chief Justice Marshall in that case was that that it's the province and the duty of the judicial department, that is the judicial branch, it's the province and duty of the judicial branch to say what the law is. So there was a statute passed by Congress, but there's also the Constitution, and those two laws were in conflict. The Constitution said the court got to do one thing. The statute said that the court got to do the other thing. So those two things were in conflict, or at least maybe a kind of an imagined conflict, because the conflict in that case wasn't really all that bad. But the court said, look, we have these two conflicting principles, one in this federal statute and the other one in the federal constitution, and we have to decide which one to apply. When you look at it that way, it's pretty easy, because we have to apply the Constitution, because it was the Constitution that gave Congress the power, or in this case, didn't give them the power to pass that statute. So it's the province and the duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. And in this particular case, the law that prevails is the Constitution and not this unconstitutional statute that was adopted. And another quote in there, it's a very essence of judicial duty to see which prevails, whether it's a statute or the Constitution. So that case from 1803, Madison v. Marbury, Marbury v. Madison, that put into place the concept of judicial review. The courts are going to be the ones to decide whether a statute is constitutional or unconstitutional. So it could be any court. If it's in the small claims court and somebody comes in there trying to sue for under an unconstitutional statute, well, the judge of the small claims court is going to have to decide that, we can't rule in your favor because that statute that you're bringing in here is unconstitutional. So it really applies to any court, but ultimately we're talking about the United States Supreme Court, because that small claims court decision is ultimately going to get appealed, and ultimately that appeal is going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. So the courts, in particular the U.S. Supreme Court, these nine old men and women, have by virtue of that Marbury v. Madison case, they have the power of judicial review. It is the courts who will tell us what the Constitution means, and whether statutes and other acts taken supposedly in furtherance of that Constitution are actually valid. And then kind of along the same lines, in 1810, Marbury was 1803, 7 years later, the court ruled that, yes, it has the that same power with respect to state laws. So if some state law is in violation of the U.S. Constitution, and back then in 1810, it was harder to be for a state law to be in violation of the state constitution. But they ruled in 1810 that, yes, we have the power to invalidate state laws that are not in keeping with the Constitution. Now, that power of judicial review was used very, very sparingly over the years. And in fact, the next time the court asserted that power, the very next time that the court said that it had the power to invalidate a statute was in that case. Remember the case from our first lesson, the Dred Scott decision in the 1850s, when the court basically said that the Missouri Compromise was unconstitutional. Between that time, between 1803, when Marbury was decided, it wasn't until the 1850s, in that very dubious case, that power was asserted again. Now, it gets asserted a lot more after that. But in the early days of that power, it was not widely used by the Supreme Court. Those nine old men, they were nine old men at the time. They did not use that power very often. In fact, the very first time they did, in the 1850s, they kind of, I think we could all agree, they pretty well messed it up. So if you remember the name of one case in the field of constitutional law, I guess I would say that you should remember the name Marbury v. Madison, that 1803 case, which says that, yes, the United States Supreme Court or the courts in general have the power to declare what the law is. Namely, they have the power of judicial review. They can tell whether a statute is constitutional or unconstitutional. Well, now we've figured out who interprets what the Constitution says. Now we have to actually look into it and see, well, what does the Constitution actually say? We've figured out the kind of one of the means of deciding what's in the Constitution. But as we mentioned before, you know, the starting point is obviously what are the actual words of the Constitution. What is the Constitution? Well, the Constitution defines what the government is, and it grants powers to the federal government. It says, here is what the government of the United States is able to do. What did we have before the Constitution? Well, we had the Articles of Confederation. The original 13 states were kind of loosely banded together, but those 13 states clung to their sovereignty, and they did not give the national government very much power. Most of that power was vested in the state capitals under the Articles of Confederation. And that really wasn't working out too well. So the Constitution was put together to make a stronger government. I guess I wouldn't say a strong government, but definitely a stronger government than was in place under the Articles of Confederation. And it didn't just give a blank check. It gave enumerated powers to the federal government. It listed the powers that the federal government is able to carry out. So anytime the federal government acts, does anything, in theory anyway, the government has to be able to point to something in the Constitution that says, yes, we have the authority to do this. Some are pretty easy. It says right there in the Constitution that that Congress or the federal government shall establish a post office. You can't really argue that too much. If Congress appropriates money to open a post office to deliver mail to people, well, that's clearly within their power, because that is one of the enumerated powers. It says they're right in the Constitution. They shall establish a post office. So that's an easy one. Most of them, though, are a little bit harder, because, for example, it says Congress shall regulate commerce among the states. Well, what exactly does that mean? You know, it's pretty, I guess it's kind of an easy case if I have a container load of widgets that I'm shipping from Minnesota to Wisconsin, and it crosses the state line, and somebody in Wisconsin pays me in Minnesota for sending the widgets. Well, that's a pretty clear case of commerce among the states. But what if I operate a hotel and I've never left the state, but I have people checking into my state, my hotel, and sometimes they're from other states? Is that interstate commerce? Now we learned in the 1950s that it is. But that's a harder case. That's not as easy a case as saying, the Congress shall create a post office. So the federal government is a government of enumerated powers. Now that might be a little bit, I think it's pretty clear from just reading the original text of the Constitution that it's a government of enumerated powers. But if there's any doubt about it, it's kind of resolved by the 10th Amendment. So the 10th Amendment was put in there just to clarify that, just to make sure that everybody understood that it's a government of enumerated powers, because the 10th Amendment says that any rights not specifically mentioned in the Constitution shall be reserved to the individual states and to the people. So it kind of clarified that, yes, it is indeed a government of enumerated powers that this Constitution created. Now, some of those enumerated powers I encourage you to read the actual text of the Constitution, but some of those enumerated powers are listed at the bottom of page 32 of your text. They include the power to lay and collect taxes. So, yes, the Congress can levy taxes on people. It can borrow money. It can declare war. That's an important power of Congress that really hasn't been exercised since about 1941. Congress has the power to raise and support armies. And a couple of others, the post office to print money, example. To make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying out the powers listed above. So that's the necessary and proper clause. Congress can print money, because that's one of the things that's specifically listed in the Constitution. But if they have to pass some other laws that are necessary and proper to be able to do that, passing a law to buy the ink to print the money with, they can do that because that's necessary and proper. But like the Commerce Clause we just mentioned, what exactly does that mean? What is a law that's necessary and proper to carry out those ends? So that there's room for a lot of litigation. So that's good news for lawyers, I guess, that we can be busy litigating what these issues are, what is necessary and proper. But again, the key thing to take away is that the powers of the federal government are enumerated powers. They can't just do anything they want. If the U.S. government wants to do something, they have to be able to point to something specifically in the Constitution that says, yes, they legitimately have this power to do this thing. Now, an important part of that power, probably that comes into play, probably the thing that the government will point to more often than anything else, is that Commerce Clause in the Constitution. because the Commerce Clause says that the federal government has the power to regulate commerce among the several states and with foreign countries and with the Native Americans. That and just about everything that Congress has done in the last century, or many of the things that they've done, if you ask them, well, why did you pass this law? Well, they'll point to it and say, because of the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause is the thing that gives us power. Because if I operate a hotel that is solely within the boundaries of one state, it's pretty clear that, I am taking part in nationwide commerce because people from other states are going to come check into my hotel. So the Civil Rights Act, in the 1960s, Congress said, you can't discriminate against people because of their race. If you have a public accommodation, such as a hotel, the reason why they have the power to do that is because of the Commerce Clause. So the Commerce Clause comes up in many things, are related to commerce, but it doesn't really have too much to do with the actual commerce itself. But clearly it has an important effect upon commerce. So that's why Congress has the power to do that. What exactly does that mean? Well, the pendulum swings on that. And in fact, as early as 1824, the Supreme Court looked at that and said that, well, when it says they used the word among in the Constitution, it said trade commerce among the states. It didn't say commerce between the states. It didn't say only if you ship your widgets across a state line will the Commerce Clause come into play and give the federal government power to regulate that commerce. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say commerce between the states. It says commerce among the states. So as early as 1824, the Supreme Court recognized that actions in the field of commerce that have effects beyond the state, even though that action takes place solely within one state, that is interstate commerce, and the federal government has the power to regulate that. On the other hand, the pendulum swings, and by 1895, the Supreme Court famously ruled that manufacturing stuff is not part of commerce. So manufacturing is not commerce. So if I ship my widgets from Minnesota to Wisconsin, I guess that's commerce. That's interstate commerce. But if I manufacture those widgets in Minnesota, knowing full well that they're going to get shipped to another state, that is not commerce because that is manufacturing. By 1895, they'd kind of forgotten when they had said, the word among does not mean the same thing as the word between. And they held that, manufacturing in one state is not part of commerce. And that position prevailed up until about 1935, when the Schechter case come along. And I can't even tell you how to spell Schechter, because most people don't know that case by that name. That case is known as the Sick Chicken case, because during the New Deal, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt had the federal government have a very, very, very hands-on regulation of the economy, including if you're a chicken dealer in one state, had very specific regulations on how you pick out the chicken that you sell to somebody. So in the Schechter case, we had this one chicken being sold somewhere that was probably going to be, it was sold in that state, it was grown in that state, it was eaten in that state, and You know, what does that have to do with interstate commerce? But the and the Supreme Court agreed with that position, kind of along the same lines of that 1895 case that said manufacturing is not commerce because it's solely within one state. So these all these regulations that were handed down by FDR as part of the New Deal, the Supreme Court tossed them out. And said, no, the federal government does not have any business regulating the sale of chickens that take place solely within one state, whether they're sick or whether they're not sick. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's not the province of the federal government. If anybody is going to regulate selling of sick chickens, it should be the state governments. And incidentally, the sick chicken, I don't remember exactly what the regulation in that case was, but the you know, when I first read this case, I thought to myself, what does this have to do with ending the Depression? Because it was a regulation, kind of basically a federal regulation. It was put in by local boards or whatever, but it said, a chicken dealer, you know, if you're selling chickens, you can't play favorites. You have to, the next person walks in to buy a chicken and the next chicken in line happens to be a sick chicken, well, then you have to sell the sick chicken to that person. You can't say, oh, you're a favorite customer of mine. I'm gonna find you a good chicken here. That was the regulation at issue there. And I always wonder, what the heck does that have to do with ending the Depression? And I still wonder that. What does all this massive federal involvement in commerce have to do with ending the Depression? And the thought was, and I don't agree with this, but at least it makes a little bit of sense when it was explained to me ultimately, was that the feeling was that one of the causes of the Depression was just unbridled competition. They felt that the reason why we're stuck in a depression is because there's unbridled competition, and we have to bridle the competition a little bit, and by doing things like making commerce fair. So if you happen to walk in, even though you're a favored customer and the sick chicken is the next chicken in line, well, you know, I'm sorry, but you're just gonna have to take the sick chicken. So there's a little bit of a rationale behind it, I guess. But I still have my doubts. But in any event, the Supreme Court back in 1935 in the sick chicken case said, no, the federal government should not have that kind of broad power over local meat markets somewhere. Now, the pendulum has started to swing back. And back in the day, some observers said that the reason why the pendulum started swinging back was that a switch in time saves nine, because when this sick chicken case was handed down by the Supreme Court, FDR wasn't particularly happy about that, and he got in his mind that what he was going to do was he was going to expand the Supreme Court. So he had these nine old men told him that he was not allowed to regulate the economy. Well, he was going to put in, 10, increase the size of the court, have Congress pass a law saying that the Supreme Court shall be made up of 19 judges. I don't know if that was the exact number they picked, but have a Supreme Court made up of 19 judges. And then who gets to pick the new 10 judges? Well, it would be him. So he was going to pack the court. With the new Supreme Court with 19 members, the nine old men that were there before that ruled against him, plus the 10 new old men who were going to rule in his favor, then he would start winning cases by 10-9 or whatever. So there was this his idea to pack the court, and some observers say that a switch in time saved nine. that the Supreme Court kind of saw this coming and they were afraid. And then in some of their future rulings, they backed down a little bit from the sick chicken case. Now, I don't know if that's really true, because it's kind of outside the scope of this course. But if you read some of the later cases in the New Deal, it's clear that FDR did not, and the administration did not go quite so far as they had in the sick chicken case. So I think if you look at those cases, the ones before and after the switch in time that saved nine, it's not really clear that there was a switch. Those cases can be reconciled, I think. And so they never overruled the sick chicken case. If another sick chicken case had come along, that would have been the precedent to be applied. So many people say a switch in time saved nine. I kind of have my doubts about that. But like I say, that pendulum keeps swinging back and forth. Most recently, the Obamacare decision, where the U.S. Supreme Court ruled upon the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare. There was a question of whether or not it was valid. The Supreme Court ruled that no, it's not invalid, because it's not proper under the Commerce Clause, forcing somebody who's completely within one state. They said it's basically the same thing as the sick chicken case, telling you that you have to buy this particular kind of product, or telling somebody that you have to sell that chicken. That is not valid under the commerce power. Now, I see a bunch of you getting ready to raise your hand and say, well, wait a minute. I thought they decided Obamacare was okay. Yes, they did, because they said, well, even though it's not valid under the Commerce Clause, remember, one of the things that we said that the U.S. Congress had the power to do, that is to levy taxes. Well, they said this is basically a tax. It's not a very big tax, and it's even called a penalty. But there's a provision in there that says that you have to go out and buy Obamacare. You don't really have to, but if you don't, you have to pay the penalty. You have to pay X dollars, right there on your tax form. Even though it's called something else, it's right there in your 1040 form. If you didn't buy your Obamacare, add X number of dollars to this line. So even though it's not valid under the Commerce Clause, it was held to be valid under the taxing power. So that's why Obamacare was held to be constitutional. The other holding of that case, though, is that it was not constitutional under the Commerce Clause. So that pendulum is going to swing. From 1826 until the present, it swings back and forth. Kind of depends. If you look at something, is this valid under the Commerce Power? Well, it kind of boils down to, when is the Supreme Court making that decision? Or really, which nine old men are sitting on the court at that particular time, or women? So those, what we've talked about right now, I kept saying that the power of the federal government, can the federal government do these things? And really, when we say that, we're talking about Congress. Those are the powers vested in Congress. Congress can regulate trade between the various states. Congress ultimately decides what laws and policies are carried out by the federal government. So really, when we say Congress has the power to do this, that's really another way of saying that the government has the power to do this. But the other separate aspect of we have this guy called the president, and what is the power of the president of the United States? Again, the president has some specific enumerated powers, but here, the Supreme Court doesn't question quite so much particular actions of the president. Particular actions of the president will not will not trigger an analysis of, well, was this an enumerated power? Because there's also an understanding that the chief executive of the country does the things that are inherently within the power of a chief executive. So there's less of a look at it, but there are some enumerated things, some specific things that the president is entitled to do. Perhaps one of the most powerful of those is that the president of the United States is the commander in chief of the United States Armed Forces. So if you're a private, he enlisted in the army, and the president of the United States gives you an order. Well, I guess you have to do it. I mean, I guess that would normally be filtered down the chain of command, but the president of the United States gives orders to the military because he is the commander in chief. So if you're in the army or the navy, you have to do what the president tells you to do. But there's a little bit of intentional ambiguity in the Constitution, because it says, yeah, the president is the commander in chief. So can the president say, let's go to war against England or name some country? Well, no, the president can't do that, because the Constitution also says that who has the power to declare war? It's the Congress that has the power to declare war. So what exactly does that mean? That can lead to a lot of uncertainty, can't it? And in fact, have we had any wars since 1945? Well, yeah, last I checked, we've had a lot of wars since 1945. But the last time Congress declared war was in 1941 with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And that war ended in 1945, and there's never been a declared war since 1945. But there have been wars. So it's kind of a delicate balance, because, even though there's no declaration of war, there's no declaration of war saying that the United States is at war with North Korea, or that the United States is at war with North Vietnam, or that the United States is at war with the Taliban regime, or that there's never been a declaration that the United States was at war with Iraq. But we had all those wars. So there's a tension there, because even though the Congress has the power to declare war, the president is the one who actually gives the orders saying, go over to this place and start shooting, which is kind of the definition of war. So it's kind of a delicate balance. There's been an uneasy truce between the legislative and the executive branches, because in all of those cases, there's usually been some sort of authorization for military force that was passed by Congress. So the Congress did not say, we are declaring war on Afghanistan, or declaring war on Iraq, or declaring war on Vietnam. There's never been a declaration of war, but there have been, in those cases, authorizations to military force. So there is Congress passed legislation saying, Mr. President, we are not declaring war, but we give you authorization to send our military to these other places. That's kind of the balance is kind of reflected in the War Powers Resolution of 1973. It's a resolution passed by Congress. Every president since then, or most of them anyway, have asserted that the War Powers Resolution is an unconstitutional usurpation by Congress of the president's power as commander in chief. And the Congress would say, well, no, that's part of our duty to declare war. So Congress has never declared war, but under this War Powers Resolution, there are provisions that saying if the United States president sends military members to another country, the president has to consult with Congress. So the president has to say, I am sending X number of soldiers to Iran or to Iraq or whatever. The president has to notify Congress, has to consult, and then there are some time limits where it says within X number of days the Congress will pass a resolution authorizing that military force, it's worked out since then. There hasn't been any major constitutional crises, although there's always a tension that the president has more or less always grudgingly gone along with giving that consultation, and Congress has more or less always grudgingly gone along and saying, within their time limit, saying, okay, I guess you can keep them there. But that's one area where the courts are never going to get involved, or I can never say never, but something called the political question doctrine. Even though the Supreme Court says that, yes, we have the power to decide what the law is, they have deferred that authority. They say we will not take cases that are political questions. So under the political question doctrine, the Supreme Court has said we will never involve ourselves in controversies like that. It's ultimately up to the voters. We have to if Congress either does or doesn't act properly, well, we should vote them out of office. Or if the president does or doesn't act properly, well, we should vote them out of office. So that's a political question. It's not for the courts to decide whether or not because I guess these nine old men and women. Have decided they're probably not the best people to come to for military advice. So for that, they say we're going to defer to the other branches of government and let them fight it out, because that's a political question. And ultimately, it's the voters who have to decide that. On the other hand, sometimes there might be some subsidiary issues where the courts do work their way in. So, for example, in 2004, on the question of, what about detainees at Guantanamo Bay? Is there a right of judicial review of the procedures going on in their in those military proceedings? And they said, to a certain extent, yes, there is. So even though that delicate balance of power between the legislative and executive branches with respect to the military, there are some areas where perhaps the court will allow itself to intervene. But in general, those questions, it says, those are political questions, best resolved by the political process. Therefore, the Supreme Court is going to keep its nose out of those things. The last issue addressed by the Constitution is what about the powers of the states? We've talked about the federal government and what are their powers and responsibilities. We still have these 13 states, or now we're up to 50 states. What about them? The Constitution does have some things to say about them, but also it has some things. Some things go unsaid, are not in the Constitution, and that is, there's an assumption that the government, whatever the government is. So if you're in France, there's an assumption that the French government has the right to put people in jail if they commit a crime. That seems reasonable. Or if you're in Germany, there's kind of an assumption that the German government has the right to stop air pollution. There are general police powers that we believe belong to government, and because nothing is said about them, and they're not enumerated powers, those residual powers, that other power of government, that belongs to the state in what we call the general police power. You'll hear that phrase a lot of time in court decisions, that this was a proper exercise of the state's general police power. So if the state of Minnesota has somebody arrested for burglarizing somebody, that's a proper exercise of the state's police power. Governments do that sort of thing. If you committed a burglary in France, the French police would put you in jail. If you murdered somebody in England, the English government would put you in jail. So if you did one of those things in Minnesota, the Minnesota government would put you in jail. You have that power by virtue of the fact that you are a government. That is one of the general police powers of the state. The title of this section of the program is Federalism. Federalism addresses the question of, how are powers distributed between the federal government, the national government, and the state governments? That is a question of federalism. So when you hear somebody talking about federalism, you know that they're talking about the question of, is this thing that we're talking about, is that part of the general police power of the state, or is it one of the enumerated powers of the federal government, or perhaps is it both? That's the question of federalism. And there's a tension here too, because we've already hinted that there's a 10th Amendment. We mentioned that, and I don't think the 10th Amendment really had to be said. That's kind of implied that the federal government can only have only has its enumerated powers. It can only build a post office because the Constitution said it could build a post office. If the framers had left out that phrase, well, then that would not be a proper exercise of government power for the federal government. So the 10th Amendment makes that explicit. It says if we don't mention something, then it's reserved for the states and or for the people. So that's pretty clear, I guess. But it gets a little bit more complicated because there's also something called the Supremacy Clause. And the Supremacy Clause says that if the Constitution says something, then that is the supreme law of the land. Well, that's pretty easy. The Constitution says that the president has to be 35 years old. Well, that's the supreme law of the land. Not much disputing about that. Or, where it gets a little bit more difficult, is laws made in furtherance of the Constitution. So if Congress passes a law in furtherance of the Constitution, saying that there will be a post office, but, this is where the post office is going to be, this is how much the postage is, those are pretty clearly, if Congress passes a law saying that a stamp is going to cost 55 cents, well, that's pretty clear that that's a law in furtherance of the Constitution. But when you get to more difficult cases, well, what does it mean that a law is in furtherance of the Constitution? So you get attention there because you have the 10th Amendment, basically saying that, the government has only enumerated powers, but you have the Supremacy Clause saying, but if they do have that power, it is supreme. There's no middle ground. So that can cause a lot of problems. And the key word that you have to know here is preemption. If something does come under the Supremacy Clause, if it is a legitimate use of federal government power, then the state law is preempted. The doctrine of preemption comes into play. If the state of Wisconsin passes a law saying, if you want to mail a letter in Wisconsin, it's only going to cost you 54 cents. Well, that would be unconstitutional because that would be preempted because there's a federal law enacted in furtherance of the Constitution saying that stamps shall cost 55 cents. So if the state of Wisconsin tries to sell it at a lower price, you can't do that because it's under the Supremacy Clause. And that's a very clear case where the federal supremacy comes into play. Unfortunately, when you get real cases, they're not quite as simple as that one. But that's ultimately what you have to do. Where it gets really maybe a little bit more complicated. Now, if um, let's say if the federal government passed a law saying that all cars on the highway have to be safe, and I think pretty clearly that you could make the argument that, well, that clearly comes under the Commerce Clause because these cars are driving on the interstate highways. That's Congress's power to regulate. So if Congress says all cars sold in the United States have to have seat belts, that's a proper exercise of federal power, I think. And I think that would probably be a pretty easy case if some state passed a law saying, you don't need seat belts in our state. I think it's pretty clear that would be preempted. But where it gets more complicated is under what's called the Dormant Commerce Clause. What if Congress didn't specifically act on something? And that was what the issue that came up in the case of Kassel, Kassel versus Consolidated Freightways, a case from 1981. That's kind of one of the leading cases talking about the Dormant Commerce Clause. Because it was about the length of trucks. How long can your truck be? And there was no federal law. There was no federal law saying this is how long a truck can be. You can have a truck with one semi-trailer, save a little bit of money on labor and fuel and everything by putting two semi-trailers behind it. I guess that's okay. We can do that. But there's no federal law talking about it. What about three trailers? How many trailers can you add on there? Well, one state, I forget what state it was even, they put a limit. I don't remember if it was one or two. But in this state, you were not allowed to have a truck longer than a certain length. And there was no federal law whatsoever on that subject. But every other state nearby allowed longer trucks. So I forget what states they were. It was even. But let's say it was just hypothetically, let's say it was Wisconsin allowed really long trucks, and South Dakota allowed really long trucks. Well, you're a truck driver coming through Wisconsin on your way to South Dakota, an Interstate 90, and you have a truck, and you're clearly engaged in interstate commerce, but you get to Minnesota, you're not allowed in because your truck is too long for Minnesota. So one of those trucking companies brought that case and brought it to the Supreme Court. The opinion is a little bit muddy, they said that that state in the middle, you have to kind of be harmonized with your neighboring states. Now, part of the reason why they were able to do that maybe a little bit more easily is because there were some exceptions for in-state trucks over that limit that kept out the out-of-state people. But a little bit of a controversial decision because some of the states argued that, well, no, that's within our legitimate police power. And besides, Congress hasn't said anything. If Congress came along and said, this is the maximum length for trucks nationwide, that would be a lot easier case. But even in the absence of that, the Supreme Court says, no, there's also this dormant Commerce Clause lurking there. So that, if every other state allows something and you are your state is the odd man out, saying, no, those trucks are not allowed through our state, even though they're allowed in the other 49, that violates the Commerce Clause. That violates the Dormant Commerce Clause. Finally, another way that... I said the Commerce Clause was a big way that the federal government asserts power over things. The other one, though, that made clear is, if Congress gives away money, that money can come with strings. And that was the holding of South Dakota versus Dole, a 1987 case, because the U.S. Congress said that, here, have some money. You know, we're handing off this highway money, and you can use our money to build highways in your state. And nobody complained when the money started coming their way. But then in around 1987, or before 1987, I guess, the Congress said, well, wait a minute, though. I tell you what, if we want the drinking age nationwide to be universal, we want it to be a 21-year-old drinking age throughout the United States. Well, there's no enumerated power talking about the drinking age. You know, it doesn't say in the Constitution, you know, the Congress can build post offices and fund armies and set drinking ages. It doesn't say anything about that. That's not a federal power. And it doesn't really come under the Commerce Clause or doesn't come under anything else. But if the federal government is handing out money and you're willing to take it and they put strings along with it, then the Supreme Court in South Dakota versus Dole said, you can do that. So that's another area of federal power, even though it's not one of the enumerated powers to set drinking ages or do a lot of things. Well, you can, in the holding of that case is Congress can go beyond what it would otherwise be able to do by adding strings to money that it appropriates. So anyway, in the last hour and a half or so, we've covered the U.S. Constitution. We've talked about the powers of government as enumerated or as defined in the Constitution. This, obviously we've just scratched the surface. This would be a full semester or a full year in law school. But again, just kind of refreshed our mind on the points that were raised. And in our next lesson, we will still be talking about constitutional law. But in most law schools, it's a different course because we're talking about constitutional rights. Up until now, we've talked about the structure of government. And next, we will be talking about the rights of the people that are defined or recited in the Constitution. I guess I would argue that those rights come to you by virtue of being a human, because they are human rights. But they are enumerated, they are listed, they are specified by the Constitution. So that's the other half of the Constitution that we will start talking about when we get to lesson 3.